morning we're going to continue a description, I hope, of some of the characteristics of change. Yesterday we got started, although we never got to a description of about five or six characteristics of massive change. I want to ask the question whether when you compare periods that are claimed to be periods where some age has come to an end and another age begins, such as the first century or the Reformation, or some would say the 20th century, do you find common characteristics of change? And I'm focusing on a particular kind of change, a change in how people see things and understand themselves, and a change in the way their value systems, their world view, as is sometimes said, their outlook on life. Today I brought a little clock, so I'm not always wondering what time it is, and so that can have some time for discussion. I would like to just walk through these characteristics of change, try them on for size, discuss them with you, and then offer just a couple of implications for Christian faith at the end. One question that came up yesterday that we didn't address is, what is the relationship of new and old in a time of massive change? I think our intuition is that the new replaces the old in our values or in our lifestyle or habits when you undergo massive change. However, that's not the case, I think. The new doesn't simply replace the old. Rather, the power of a new way of looking at things, and someone recommends to you a different way of understanding what's happening in the world, the power of the new is its ability to take up and make sense of the old in a way that the old didn't. The old couldn't account for new developments, but the new is able to account for them and take up the old. Let me give you an example. Or maybe more carefully said, people in a time of change can't quite make up their minds about the relationship of the new and the old. This is illustrated in Christian materials in the very first century. The early church can't quite decide whether Jesus represents something dramatically new or whether Jesus is the fulfillment of their very heritage. They can't quite make up their mind whether Jesus represents a drastic break from the past, and so they talk of new humanity, new creation, new age, or whether Jesus is bringing to a consummation that which represents where their deepest roots are. And so they talk about new, but what? New Israel. Or Jesus as the fulfillment of what? The prophets. And so this characteristic, I think, is one that runs through times of massive change. You can't quite make up your mind about the relationship of the old and the new, but the power of the new way of seeing things and understanding things is a power that comes from being able to make sense of the old and pick it up in a way that it might not have itself. And then the old persists, but in a new constellation. So then the early church continues to hold the Old Testament as part of its canon, but reads it through the event of Jesus Christ. Well, I think that occurs not just in Christian materials, but at almost every age, so that the Reformation, for example, said that it was online with what the true tradition of the church was. It represents a bringing the past into it. There's something else that runs counter, I think, to our usual intuitive response. First of all, saying that the new doesn't simply replace the old. I think it's on the basis of some of the old, something of our past or something of our society's past, on the very basis of it, that some of the most dramatic and far-reaching changes occur. So that this may be a little awkward, but would like to put it like this. Selected continuity is the key to revolutionary discontinuity. That means that the most effective breaks with the past come by reinterpreting the past on the basis of some of its own traditions. Every revolutionary, a good revolutionary, knows that you don't simply say, we're going to do away completely with Mother Russia. They say, we're going to do away with the Tsar, but the true Russia will then come to expression. And you draw upon some of the most loved traditions and make them the basis of some of the most far-reaching change. So that transformation or major change in a society of any lasting sort results from growing the new from stocks with deep roots or grafting on to old stocks. Wise revolutionaries are the ones that know that. Foolish ones are those that disregarded it and discovered it too late and tried to make some dramatic new programs in a society that had no roots. And it didn't work. Too much resistance. Another characteristic, the old way of seeing things and doing things must come to a point of very deep crisis, maybe several crises, and play itself out before some alternative can take hold, so that the new must emerge from a terrific wrestling with the past and the present at the strongest points and not just the weakest points. I'll say what I mean by that. You have to show that the present way of doing things and seeing things is weakest just where it made its strongest claims. That what it regarded as its strength turned out like the gods to have feet of clay. And when those much-touted strengths in fact show themselves to be weaknesses, then the new can emerge. There are a lot of people now, and I throw this out for your consideration, who are saying that that is exactly what's happening in heavy industrial societies, whether capitalist industrial societies like ours or Marxist or socialist industrial societies. That is to say, what we've regarded as our greatest strengths, namely our production and consumption virtuosity, is rapidly becoming a huge liability. It is grinding up its own foundations, whether it's doing it so by use of resources, or whether we've put together a society too complex to be managed by human beings without coming apart. That's an example, some would say, of this phenomenon, that the established way of seeing things is coming to a point of deep crisis precisely where it feels its strengths have been. Well, what I'm saying is that the characteristics of massive change are that that's what must happen before the new can take hold. The old must come to a point of crisis. Now, in a society on the edge, if it's living between times, just on the edge of massive change, the old often reasserts itself with great rigor. And what you have are a number of what you might call neo-fundamentalism, things which have been characteristic of that society in the past, gain new life for a short time, and people feel very comfortable with something that has been a strain in the past. And so things that you thought were kind of passé now come back with new life. And these groups that represent these resurgence of the old become counter-movements to the groups that are regarded as on the edge of things. Different logics or different ways of seeing things occur so that people find them so far apart from even their neighbors that you have this feeling that in explanation to your neighbor, I just can't see things your way. They just don't make sense to me. And you find yourself in an age where you're just shaking your head at all sorts of things that are occurring. One sociologist says that in such times of societies on the edge of transformation where you have this resurgence of the old in new forms, there's often what he calls a sunset effect. That is, the rekindled way of seeing things may, like the setting sun, exhibit their finest, most colorful burst of glory just before going under. You have a kind of resurgence of some movements that you have a sense that it's their last but glorious presentation of themselves. Okay, a next characteristic. Cultural conversion or widespread social transformation happens when what were former weaknesses acquire compelling power. A disenfranchised majority, a neglected or a repressed minority, or a newly converted, a changed majority or minority now comes to reign, to have a place in the society it never held before. What was a minority becomes a majority. There are some fascinating pieces again in the New Testament. The people, when this happens, even the people who come to have a special place in society are a bit surprised. Listen to Paul. He can't quite get over what's happened with the power of this tiny group in the New Testament church and the place that it's come to have. In Corinthians, he writes in the first chapter, "My brothers, think what sort of people you are whom God has called. Few of you are men of wisdom by any human standard. Few are powerful or highly born. Yet to shame the wise, God has chosen what the world counts folly. And to shame the strong, God has chosen what the world counts weakness. He has chosen things low and contemptible, mere nothings, to overthrow the existing order." People who are weak, powerless, not regarded as wise by the world standards, were the very vehicles that overthrew the existing order. Paul's a little surprised at that. Or Walt Bowman's Bible study in Mark, he cited the verse from Mark 12, where Jesus comes into confrontation with the then established powers, chief priests, lawyers, elders. This confrontation happens to take place on their own turf. It's in the temple courtyard. And then Jesus asks, when they ask what he's about, can it be you've never read this text? Picks it up then from the old, well, then the Hebrew Bible. "The stone which the builders rejected has become the main cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing, and it is wonderful in our eyes." The stone which the builders rejected, which the present society did not regard as being significant, becomes the head of the corner. Cultural conversion happens when former weaknesses acquire power. The response to that incident with Jesus, incidentally, is not unfamiliar in the history of confrontation between those seeking to preserve their place and those aspiring to take it. That next verse is, "Then they began to look for a way to arrest him. But they were afraid of the people, so they left him alone and went away." The weak one was beginning to attain compelling power because several had joined him. Okay, a couple more characteristics. At some point, the special and powerful place of tradition comes to be widely sensed, despite an initial reaction that people are going to replace the old. At some point, people start to look to tradition for some guidance, and so they try to recapture a perceived golden age, or they search out their own roots, whether in an ethnic community. They try to anchor themselves in maybe a family past, or a past of some vision that guides them, or a past that has to do with for earlier generations. And then these things are to provide them with some guidance for the future. Or they look to a kind of charter vision or the scriptures of a people or a society or a culture that might be rediscovered as a way for the future. Next characteristic. There's a political slogan. It goes like this: you can't beat somebody with nobody. What that means for times of massive change is that until there are the makings of an alternative way of seeing and doing things, people will persist in their old ways, even when they don't like it. Even when they feel even repulsed by it, until they can see another way, they won't change, unless they are, of course, forced to from pressures from outside. So the old patterns persist even when people might feel that they are bankrupt. A wonderful little scene in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. It goes like this. Alice is saying this. "It'll be no use their putting their heads down and saying, 'Come up again, dear.' I shall only look up and say, 'Who am I then? Tell me that first. And then if I like being that person, I'll come up. If not, I'll stay down here until I'm somebody else.'" Show me what the future might look like. And when I see that, then maybe. Otherwise, I'm staying down here until I become somebody else. Then I'll come up. So even self-understanding and people's identity is involved here. Okay, you can't beat somebody with nobody. Until the makings of an alternative vision are there, people will persist in their present behavior patterns. A dilemma occurs at this point because you feel that something must be different, and yet you can't see with clarity what that different future is. So you plant all sorts of seeds. So it becomes times, between times, become times of social experimentation. All sorts of things develop where people are trying on to make sense of things. And they may go with them for a little while and then abandon them. People sort of hop around from one way of making sense of the world to another way of making sense of the world, trying to figure out, like Alice, who I will be if I should come up. And you don't really know which ones in this transition time, which seeds should be planted and which should be nourished. So you try lots of different ones. One more, and then some implications for Christian faith. In times of transition, or times between times, times caught between old age and an emerging age, those persons and communities who do seek to embody a new way of seeing and doing things usually play the role of the fool when they occur. And when they speak, it's a strange word. They look weird to most people. And yet you have some kind of sense that they're saying something important. But as is often the case, so it has a kind of ring of truth about it, at least partial truth, and yet it's a word before its time, so to speak. The ground isn't quite ready yet. And so these persons in these communities are regarded as eccentric or quaint or maybe entertaining, strange, and yet you have some sense that they're to be taken seriously. They're unsettling movements. The problem, I guess, is that it's very difficult in the end to tell the true fools who genuinely represent the future only early on from the damn fools, and they may have a hard time understanding that themselves and not knowing where they represent something truly emerging and where they just represent something stupid. But such times need fools, and especially communities of them that will anticipate the future and show that it can be done, will try it on. David Riesman, who is a sociologist, calls this the important place of utopian thinking. By that he means these communities that try to anticipate a future. It may be quite out of line with the present, but and it may be dreaming, but so we call it utopian. I'll read you a paragraph from Riesman. A revival of the tradition of utopian thinking seems to be one of the most important tasks of our time. Since we live in a time of disenchantment, such thinking, where it is rational in aim and method and not mere escapism, is not easy. It is easier to concentrate on programs for choosing among lesser evils, even to the point where those evils can scarcely be distinguished from one another. But there is always a market for lesser evil thinking, which poses immediate alternatives within wrong systems. The need for thinking which confronts us with great hopes and great plans is not so evident. Yet without great plans, it is hard, often self-defeating, to make little ones. Such utopian thinking requires what I have termed the nerve of failure. Nice little term. Not the failure of nerve. The nerve of failure. That is, the ability to face the possibility of defeat without feeling morally crushed. Without this sort of courage, any failure implies a personal defect and brings a feeling of intolerable isolation. To avoid this fate, people tend to repress their claims for a decent world to some practical point and to avoid any goals, personal or social, that seem out of step with common sense. He's saying that in times of massive change, the present system poses the alternatives, as living within any system does. It restricts, poses the alternatives. Lots of those are alternatives within the wrong system, and people are attracted to that, or he calls that lesser evil thinking. What you need is someone who stands, tries something outside of the rules of the game, and that's required at such a time, but it requires a nerve of failure. Someone who will take that chance on the future and not be morally crushed when they fail. I think that if you look at both Old Testament and New Testament materials, you find exactly that going on in Israel and in the early church. In Israel in exile, for example, when the future looked very bleak and people were trying to wrestle with how do we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, when people were just fighting for sheer survival and trying to make sense of a strange situation, it is the prophets with the prophetic vision that in a time of feeling constraints, when everyone else feels constraints, they dream grander dreams. And likewise, the early church dreams grander dreams just when all sorts of other people feel the world is coming apart around them. And that's the function of the utopian community. Okay, then a couple of implications or maybe characteristics of Christian faith in a time of massive change. When there is great change in a society, major change usually also occurs in those religious traditions that have become part of that culture. And so I want to ask whether Christian faith, too, is subject to change under these kinds of conditions. I think our initial response is that a great world religion has a kind of fixed content that persists through the ages and isn't subject to change with major change in the society. I think if you look at the history of Christianity, you'll find something quite different going on. George Lindbeck, a historian at Yale, says this: revolutions in Christianity occur when the Christian story is organized and utilized in markedly different ways in order to structure and interpret new life worlds and new thought worlds. Let me try to unpack that. He says that the understanding of Christian faith itself changes in times of massive change in order to help people make sense of the change that they are undergoing, in order to structure and interpret new life worlds and new thought worlds. So he gives some examples. He says that in the first few centuries, the big discussion is between the relationship of Judaism and the traditions of Israel to the changing world, which was heavily influenced by the Greeks. What's the relationship between Judaism and Hellenism? And that occupies the discussion of the first few centuries. Then, with Constantine, the place of the church changed massively from a small minority with no influence in the social order, except that actually significant influence of gathering people in its rank. Two, with Constantine, the church becomes establishment. And then you have a change of rather massive proportions as the church asks itself, what is its place in the imperial order? Or the Reformation has a different agenda for the Christian faith than did the early Christians. It's not Judaism and Hellenism now, but something else. Paul Tillich says that one of the primary concerns for the early church is the question of death and resurrection, but for the Reformation it becomes a preoccupation with salvation and the status of the individual and guilty self before God. So instead of the message of resurrection being the primary understanding of the gospel in the Reformation time, it's a message of forgiveness. Paul Tillich says in the 50s and after the Second World War, our situation for us was what he called our age was an age of anxiety, so the gospel was heard primarily as, Tillich's terms, the courage to be. So there is within this rich religious tradition a kind of shifting of the understanding of the faith itself in keeping with the characteristics of the age, which is a way of calling upon the richness of that faith. But Christian faith then becomes a resource for structuring and interpreting new life worlds and new thought worlds. Alfred North Whitehead, a philosopher, says something about societies in change, and I think the same is true for great religious traditions. Whitehead says, that society which does not combine reverence for its symbolic code, that's just a way of saying symbolic code, he means for its essentials, that society which does not combine reverence for its essential understandings with freedom for their revision is subject to decay. I think you can say the same thing about religious faith. That religion which does not combine reverence for its essential understandings with freedom for their revisions stands a good chance of getting hardening of the arteries. and passing, as many have, out of existence. So it seems to me that one expects, if ours is a time of great change, also to confront various and often very exciting new understandings of Christian faith itself. It may be, for example, as we mentioned, some of you may have been here last week or the week before, we were talking about rich Christians in a poor world, and it was mentioned that the Gospels and almost all of the biblical materials were formed, gathered together, passed on in times when scarcity and not affluence was the normal human condition. And all of the talk about the abundant life and about the life as a life of joy was talk about that under the conditions of relative scarcity. Now, we, because we've lived in affluence, most of us, probably don't see the clues to what joy and abundant living under scarcity might be. And if you move into that as a real possibility, you might rediscover the faith itself in the process. So, that's just one example of how times of change give you new lenses for seeing the faith itself, some new eyes with your changed situation. Just as the faith, and an influence that runs the other way, may give you great help in understanding your new situation. It's a circle of influences. You get some new perspectives for viewing elements in the faith, find some things in those biblical materials you never understood before. Jesus says in this situation, let those who have ears, let them hear. Well, you might not get the ears until your situation has changed. And then it goes the other way. What you find there may help you make sense of otherwise confusing world in movement. Okay. I've said enough. Let's just open this for general discussion. I think the discussions might be the characteristics of change, might be to ask what Christian faith might mean in our situation. Just general free-for-all here. Or maybe people have Phil?
An underlying question in the whole discussion for me is what you perceive to be the value of reflection on this. Just as a foil, I would suggest that one of the effects of reflection on this is the production of a lot of what you call damned fools. People who want to be the precursors of a new age, but who don't really have the vision, and so act it out. What's the value of the kind of reflection that you led us into, which has been, I think, very insightful, very helpful?
This may be copping out. I would guess that you have some reflections about the value of that that I'd like to hear. well, a quick response. And then I'd like to hear what you have to say. A quick response from my part is simply that to understand, if such dynamics are there, to understand them is to get one handle on them. If one understands what otherwise a bewildering situation is about, it's helpful in responding to it. So it's essentially the function of any kind of knowledge.
Yeah, I suppose add to that, add to the understanding then a kind of responsibility. That is, does this understanding and this exposition help us to make an appropriate response, to be responsible? I said some things to you after the session yesterday about what I perceived to be a strong current in yesterday's thing, that the response that was being urged upon us was not this Promethean one of bringing in the new age, of manufacturing it ourselves, but there was a lot of passive voice stuff both mm-hmm. from the Bible and from some of your secular mm-hmm. authors yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let your minds be remade.
Mm-hmm.
Let your whole nature be transformed.
Yeah, the Greek that Paul, yesterday we unpacked a little bit of the verse in Romans 12 about conform no longer to this present age, but be transformed. The passive voice in the Greek is there. You are transformed. And later in the session we said that the characteristic of massive transformation is all sorts of pressures from without that transform us, and we aren't always the active agent there.
Yeah, I would want to strike a balance, I suppose, between mm-hmm. both the activity and the passivity, especially mm-hmm. in view of the, mm-hmm. the great impediment that Lutheran passivity has been
mm-hmm.
In much of our history.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very important not to just talk about how to be active in terms of
yeah.
this either. There is a humble place that
yeah.
we have. There's more happening than we are doing.
Yeah.
And for us to sit back and to understand, which your comments help us, to understand and then to take a responsible place in the midst of all that seems very
Chuck
important.
Lutz last week in the series on rich Christians in a poor world made efforts again and again to try and speak or try to lay out the agenda of poor nations in our situation now as a way of helping us to, I think he would say, let some things happen. Now there's some value judgments there, of course. But I think when you look at biblical materials, you again and again in times of major transition see an understanding of the interpreters of the faith, whether it's the prophets or others, see God as active agent in the events of history, and then one understands those events in that light, and there's a kind of passivity in this, and you receive them as expressions of God's sovereignty, actually. Yeah, good point. We said at the conclusion of the hour yesterday that really massive and lasting change comes about as a combination of two things: pressures, both internal and external, and a compelling vision. And until you acknowledge those pressures from without and don't always constantly fight them or attempt always to be the controller of them, the change doesn't occur. Or if it does, it occurs over your dead body. You know?
Well, you talk about pressures and compelling vision. Do you distinguish between means and ends towards change? How would you justify your vision using any means, or you act within certain parameters, i.e. violence versus non-violent means? Could you say something about that?
You know, are you asking that as a personal question? I mean, if I was sort of trying to describe times of change, and in that case you usually have the expression of all kinds of means. It's a different question when you ask what are proper means as a moral question to great change, and what does Christian faith say to proper means to attain change. If it's a latter kind of question, I get all troubled because I think of friends in South Africa right now, or friends in Rhodesia who are just struggling with these questions of massive transformation in their own society, asking the question, what are their responsibilities as Christians? And that question of means, are violent means ever permissible, is a live one for them. Their preference and their commitments are for nonviolent. But
do you think the gospel clearly calls us to nonviolent means?
I have no doubt that is to be the normal, in a sense, the normative bearing stance, orientation of the Christian. But that doesn't answer the hard question. Namely, are there any exceptions to that normal and normative stance.
I get a little uncomfortable when I think about change from the standpoint of at times that there may be an assumption that the change is good.
Yeah. Sort of for its own sake, that change is as change
is
good.
Either good,
yeah,
for change's sake,
yeah,
or that the old system is no good.
I think
at times the change may not be good.
Yeah,
and,
sure. Those judgments.
I don't know if that's been brought out.
Those judgments, I think that for some people, especially in the late 60s, there was a sense for a lot of people that change as such was good, and some other people said change as such is bad, which both of which were incorrect. I mean, one still has to make those moral judgments about this particular change and that particular change. There isn't a sanction for or against change as such.
Suppose there is a force to following up on that, to have some change which you perceive as not being good, or another people perceive as not being good. I think you mentioned earlier that one of the natural reactions to that is to wipe out the people who are involved in leading this change.
Yeah.
That hasn't proved real effective, at least with martyrs and things like this.
Often
what are the effective ways of dealing with change that you perceive as not being effective change?
Yeah.
Or good change? Where, you know, there are weaknesses in any system, including, you know, the status quo.
Sure.
But, and there are visions, but how would you deal with a change that you felt was not proper way to go?
Well, if you want the politician's answer, it is to pick up that which is attractive to a lot of people in that change and call it your own. Build it into your own. It's called co-opting it. And that is an effective way. It's probably more effective than the way that's often chosen, namely simply to repress it, to get rid of it in one way or another. But other people will have responses to that.
To recall the strength of the of what the change seeks to remove or alter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You recall the strength of, as you said, you know, to initiate change, you tend to seek the things that were strong and point them out as weaknesses.
Yeah.
All right, then, to suppress the change which you see as unsuitable,
yeah,
or undesirable,
yeah,
would seem that you'd have to then dig up the strength and say, well, this is really not a weakness, this is the strength,
uh-huh,
and so you can't accept this.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Paul, are you stretching or raising your hand?
Both.
Both, okay.
Do you believe that change involves or always implies some metanoia or conversion, or is that just one?
No, that's just one kind of change. Yesterday, just very briefly, we sketched three kinds of change that I think are certainly being called for, and a lot of people would say occurring. One is technological change, rather self-explanatory. Another one is changes in systems and structures, institutional change or changes in how we organize our life. That kind of change can occur without change as metanoia, which really means a dramatic change of self-understanding. And you can have very widespread change in society occur without the dramatic change of minds. Now, it eventually changed minds. That's where the Marxists are absolutely right, that if you change the way in which people relate to one another by changing the institutions of a society, you will, over the long haul, also have an impact on how they the values they hold, the beliefs that they fashion. They exaggerated that too much, but they were right, that by changing people's patterns of living, you have an effect on their how they see themselves and others. And so the Industrial Revolution is a good example, it seems to me, of how institutional change changed the whole character of society without a metanoia, without dramatic change of mind being a presupposition to it. That's one of the ironies of history, too, that people who do not intend great change are often the agents of it. Just because they're just following through, just doing their jobs, as those jobs are laid out in their institutional life. And yet that has a transforming effect on society. One of the great changes in the last 50 years has been carried out by businessmen who were not disposed to great change and dramatic changes themselves, but built a business civilization that rearranged life for all of us. And what I was talking about here, though, these characteristics are characteristics of essentially change of mind, which is more in keeping with the metanoia, that New Testament word for repentance. Very interesting word, just an interesting word, that repentance means a change or correction of outlook, and then the way of life that follows from it, a different way. The Hebrew word is, the equivalent is to turn, and to turn around, to move in a different direction. Well, I hear the coffee. Which priorities are priorities.